Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
A lot of people live in denial because they think that to be realistic is to be depressing.
I'm Dr. Mike, host of Going There.
It was the first song where I wrote about how I felt like my depression was killing me and I didn't want it.
Going There breaks the stigma of mental health issues by having real, honest conversations with your favorite musicians, including Alessia Cara, Lizzie Hale, Jewel, Jason Isbell, Gerard Way, Lauren Gray, Shamir, and Barty Strange.
There was something there that was so raw, where I was like, wow, I can't believe someone would say that.
Let's go there on Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by Sound Mind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network, every other Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey everybody, I'm Butch Vig, music producer and drummer of Garbage, and you're listening to The Story Behind the Song on Consequence.
Welcome, listeners, to The Story Behind the Song. I'm your host, Peter Chotti of Deep Cuts Media. In this very special encore episode, I reflect back on Kurt Cobain, whom we lost far too soon 30 years ago this week. To celebrate his great life and music, I revisit my interview with legendary producer Butch Vig, who produced Nirvana's classic grunge anthem, Smells Like Teen Spirit, a record that changed the shape of music in 1991 when it raged onto the post-new wave music scene. Vig also started the great band Garbage and went on to produce many of the other most iconic artists of that time, including Smashing Pumpkins, Sonic Youth, and Green Day. So take a listen as we dive deep into the story behind one of rock and roll's most iconic songs, Kurt Cobain's and Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit, with legendary music producer Butch Vig. So much to say about what you've done, obviously with Garbage, working with Shirley Manson and the band. And Shirley was a guest of mine just recently on this podcast series. So that was fun. So we went through the journey of the band and some of the songs there. We discussed Only Happy When It Rains, and it was great. And then Silver Sun Pickups were on as a guest of mine, and they were singing your praises because obviously you produced their great latest album, Physical Thrills. And just one special part of that album that I just loved, the way that songs number one and two kind of bled into each other. I thought that was really, really just so nice.
Yeah, cool. Thanks for saying that. That was a little tricky doing that, but we wanted the record to feel like it had a flow to it. And that's one of the things that the band and I discussed. So when you make those segues, it's not always easy because you write the songs separately and then you have to figure out a way to connect them. But that's part of what's fun about working in the studio, trying to figure those things out.
Yeah, no, it's so great too, because it's a full album listen, you know, and it's a full experience. I think a lot of people are beginning to come back to some of that. It's kind of like the vinyl resurgence. It's the full album, full sit down experience. So you hear the whole story of it all. And then of course, you've produced so many others, Smashing Pumpkins, their classic album, Gish, Sonic Youth, Green Day, Muse. I'm wearing my Nirvana today, but I'm also wearing my Muse.
All right. Hoodie. Very
in
cool.
Homage to you and all the work that you've done, Foo Fighters, on and on. But let's dig right into Smells Like Teen Spirit and your journey to get to the production of that. So what had you produced prior to that time? And just take us through how you got to that point where you were connected with the band and entered the studio.
Well, going way back, the guitarist Steve Marker in Garbage and myself started a recording studio called Smart Studios in Madison in like 1984, 85. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of punk bands on the local scene. And so we started recording bands like Mecht Minch and Tar Babies and The Appliances. And there was a band called Killdozer that I produced three or four albums for. They were a god-awful sound. Sort of like falling down the stairs in slow motion when you've had too many beers. But it caught the attention of a lot of bands, particularly Billy Corgan from Smashing Pumpkins. That's why he called me, because he heard the Killdozer records. And also Sub Pop called because they liked the sound of those Killdozer records. And so I started doing some records for Sub Pop. Nirvana at the time was signed to Sub Pop. And one day, Jonathan, the head there, called me and said, "Hey, Butch, we want you to produce this band, Nirvana. They could be as big as the Beatles." And I sort of laughed. Who's going to say that? What, a punk band's never going to be as big as the Beatles. Anyway, since there wasn't any internet really functioning then, he sent me some vinyl of their first record, Bleach. And I listened to it, and it was good. I was kind of unimpressed. I thought their record was kind of one-dimensional and sort of in its approach. But there was one song on there about a girl, which to me was a brilliant pop song and sounded like Lennon-McCartney-style songwriting. And I just fell in love with that song. I told Jonathan if they were coming, you know, anywhere in the Midwest on tour, they should come by and record it smart. And they were coming through to do like a six-week run through the U.S. and a lot of the shows in the Midwest. So we scheduled a week between some shows to record it smart. And that was the first time I met the band. So they came on like a Sunday, showed up like at noon, and they were really scruffy. This is when Chad was drumming for them too. This is before Dave Grohl had joined the band. And they came in and started setting up. And immediately I was taken about how friendly they were, especially Chris Novoselic. He was just super charming and funny. And Kurt was really quite affable and witty. But as soon as we started recording that day, that's the first time I realized that Kurt would have these intense mood swings. It's like a black cloud would come over him and a light switch would go off and he would just completely shut down. The first song we were recording, I thought he didn't like something or his mix was bad. And I asked Chris, you know, what's going on? And he pulled me aside and said, "It's okay. Kurt gets in these moods. You just have to let him be. He'll snap out of it." So I went in and I tinkered myself, you know, tinkered on the drum kit at tuning and things and with the amp. And then like 45 minutes later, Kurt picked up his guitar and said, "Let's go." And we recorded Sunday through Wednesday or Thursday, I think, what was ostensibly going to be an album for Sub Pop. And I think we got 6 or 7 tracks done. And then they played a show in Madison on that Thursday night. And it was at this small club downstairs in an Italian, like a pizza joint. There were maybe 75 people in the pizza parlor, and they were amazing. But Kurt sang so hard, he blew his voice out.
Yeah.
So we came in the next day, and he couldn't sing. So I think I did a couple rough mixes, and they were supposed to stay there till Saturday and leave on Sunday, and they just drove on Saturday to go to the next gig or whatever because he couldn't sing and wanted to rest his voice. So we scheduled time for them to come back about 2 months later, or maybe 2.5 months later, to finish the album. I rough mixed all the songs. I sent them to the band and I sent them to Sub Pop, and Sub Pop loved them. They were totally excited about it. And then I didn't hear anything. About 2 months later, I found out the band had taken the cassette I gave them with the rough mixes and dubbed 100 copies and gave them to all their friends.
Oh, nice.
So they basically bootlegged themselves, and then all their friends made copies, and pretty soon everybody had this underground tape of their Nirvana sessions at Smart. Needless to say, I was bummed about that, and Sub Pop was very bummed about it, but that's what led to all the major labels discovering them, and then they got into a bidding war and eventually signed with Geffen Records.
Pretty amazing how that happened, and then kind of the rest is history. It all blew up. When you are thinking about working with a band, and in that case as an example, do you spend time with them before you say, "Yes, I'm going to produce your album, and I'm going to commit to going in the studio with you and spend weeks and weeks, maybe sometimes months"? How did it work in this particular case with Kurt and the band?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. For a long time now, if I'm going to produce a band or an artist, the first thing I do is get a sense of what their vision is and who they are as people. I kind of have a rule: no vibe crushers. If someone's going to be difficult or hard to work with for whatever reason, there's probably a good chance I'm not going to take on that project. But back when I did Nirvana and a lot of those bands in like the late 80s, early 90s, basically a band would book time with me and that was it. I would just say yes, put it in the calendar and do it. There was no money for pre-production. There was no time to hang out and get to know each other and listen to demos and discuss what was going on. Bands would show up at the door, open up, we would load in their gear, and we'd be recording like 2 hours later. And that's what we did every day, every week for, you know, probably about a good 8 or 9 years. It's kind of formative in terms of how I learned how to be an engineer and producer, because you don't have time to really think. You just have to sort of react and go with your gut instinct as quickly as you can. I like to take my time getting sounds and working on getting parts down, writing and mixing, the whole process. But I think that those years were very helpful for me in learning how to be a producer, because I can, when I need to, work incredibly fast.
When did you first get the songs? Was I assume that would be prior to entering into the studio with them to produce them. And what did you think of them when you first heard them? Did you feel differently about them when you heard these particular tracks? And did Smells Like Teen Spirit stand out to you at that point?
Well, they hadn't written Teen Spirit then. Chad was still in the band. I knew that Kurt's songwriting had progressed a lot because the songs that we recorded for those Smart Sessions, like In Bloom was one of them, which is just a fantastic song and a great melody over a chord structure. Stay Away was on there. I think it might have been called Pay to Play. I had never heard them before. Kurt would say, here's a song called In Bloom, and they recorded it, you know, and then we would overdub a few guitars and vocals, and I'd get a rough mix, and then we'd get ready to move on to the next song. But I knew that he was trying to grow as a songwriter, and it was during those early Smart Sessions that, you know, we would talk at lunch break or dinner break and stuff. That's when I discovered he was a huge Beatles fan, and as much as he admired John Lennon's aesthetic, he really admired Paul McCartney's melodic songwriting, his melodic sensibility. And so I kind of filed that away as a reference point that I would use later on when we recorded Nevermind.
Take us through the journey of this particular song, Smells Like Teen Spirit, and when it presented itself, how it presented itself, what your initial reaction was, and how you went about creating the sound that you felt would optimize the impact of this, of that great song.
Well, it's funny. The band had called me and said, hey, Butch, we got signed to Geffen Records. Are you interested in producing? I said, yes, of course I am. And then I didn't hear anything for a couple of weeks. And at that time I was finishing up Gish with the Smashing Pumpkins. We recorded that at Smart Studios. We were just in the process of mixing it. And Billy Corgan kept saying, are you going to work with Nirvana or not? And I said, well, I think so, but I haven't heard anything. So I actually don't know. And it was just a short, like a couple of weeks or so after I finished Gish. Geffen wanted a big name producer, someone who had a track record, because I had no track record for major labels. It was all indie labels I'd been producing for. And then Chris called at the 11th hour and said, well, we decided we want you. We don't like any of those other bigwig producers we met, so we want you to do it. This is about a week before we're scheduled to go in the studio. Chris said, I'll send you a cassette of our rehearsal. And a couple of days later, a cassette showed up. So I put it in my cassette player in the car, I put it on, and it was Kurt. And he said, hey, Butch, we've got a new drummer. His name is Dave Grohl. He's the best drummer in the world. And I hear him go, hey, Butch. And then all said, 1, 2, 3, 4. And they kicked into Teen Spirit on the boombox. And as soon as they kicked in, it was so distorted because they recorded it on those boombox with the built-in microphones.
Yeah.
It sounded like shit. But even though it was a wall of fuzzy distortion, I could hear the song. You know, I could hear the chord progression. I could hear the hello, hello part. And all, there were a bunch of other songs on there that were great. That was the first time I heard Come As You Are. And I could tell, even though the recording was horrible, that they were really, really tight. And later I found out after we did Nevermind, they rehearsed every day for 6 months. I mean, they wanted to get in the studio and be focused. They wanted to be a machine when they played. And they really did deliver when we tracked.
So they were really disciplined. And Kurt was very disciplined when he was in the studio.
It wasn't a party. They came in and meant business. You know, I tried to keep the sessions really focused. You know, I'd be in the studio for probably 12 hours, but they were probably only in there about 7 or 8 hours. I wanted to make sure every time we recorded something, everything was set up. The drums were tuned, the guitars were all good, and just basically have them go for performance. So the first day I met Dave and heard the new songs, I flew to LA, and then I drove right to a rehearsal studio in North Hollywood, walked into this big room, and I saw that Kurt had a mic set up, and they all had talkback mic set up, and there were some wedges on the floor. I noticed there weren't any mics on Dave's kit, and usually in a rehearsal, you put at least a mic on the kick drum and the snare, and you run it into the monitor so you can hear it, right?
Yeah.
So I'm looking around and go, how's it going, guys? And Kurt was like, well, we want to play you some songs. I said, okay, let's do it. Play me a song. And they kicked into Teen Spirit. And it blew my mind how good it was. And Dave Grohl was playing the drums so hard, he didn't need microphones on them to put them into the wedges.
Yeah.
Normally what I do is I have a little pad and I take notes when I first, you know, in pre-production, when I hear something and just sketch things. Oh, this could be tighter, or maybe a different drum fill, or add a harmony here, whatever, things like that. I didn't write any notes on that first take. I just sort of paced around the room watching them. And it was so incredibly powerful. And they finished the song and there was a few seconds of silence. And Kurt said, "What do you think, Butch?" And I said, "Play it again." And they played it again. The second time I quick wrote all these notes down and started to just really process what was going on, how the interaction of how they were playing and the parts of the song, and just notes for myself that I needed for production. But man, they sounded good. And then they ran through everything that day. So that's the first time I heard everything that was going to be on the record, except the only track they didn't play was Polly, because we included that from the version they did earlier at Smart Studios for the Sub Pop sessions. But I heard all the other songs that day, and man, they were good. Kurt and the band were tight. And like I said, Kurt had really grown as a songwriter. He just had an amazing melodic sensibility.
So did that mean they felt like that was the song, their most powerful song, that they were just the most excited about? Is that why they kicked into that first?
Probably. I mean, they didn't say that, but yeah. I'm guessing that they knew that was probably going to be a focus track. I never like to tell a band, that's going to be a hit single. Like they say, this is a focus track. That means it's either really hooky or really powerful, or there's something about the song, in particular for me, that I want to pay extra special attention to in the recording. So, but I was impressed with all the songs that day. I mean, Come As You Are was great. In Bloom sounded way more powerful with Dave on drums than the original version that they had done. And so I was excited. And I only scheduled, I think, 3 or 4 days of rehearsal. And even though Geffen had told me to rehearse them for 2 weeks, I knew that that was way too much rehearsal for them, that they would get impatient and get bored.
Yeah.
That's exactly what happened. On the third day of rehearsal, Gary Gersh, the A&R guy, was supposed to come by at like 4 p.m. and just hear a few songs and chat with him. And then he was late. The band had rehearsed and they were tired of playing. Kurt just sort of left and went out to find some food. And Chris got a bottle of Jack Daniels and drank half a bottle of Jack Daniels. Then he wandered around the facility. There's all these other big rehearsal rooms. And Lenny Kravitz was in the room next to us.
Ah, nice.
And Chris went into where the main desk is and got on the PA and goes, paging Lenny Kravitz. I guess I'm going, oh my God, is that Chris? I'm running down the hall. Chris, don't do that. Get out of there.
That's funny.
And anyway, by the time Gary showed up, they were like ready to get out of there. So I don't think he even heard any music that day. But at that point, I knew, I just told him, these guys are ready to record. You know, there's no point in rehearsing anymore. I want to get them in the studio and capture the energy that they have right now. So we went into Sound City like 2 days later and started tracking.
Okay, great. That's a perfect time to take a quick break. We'll be right back in a few seconds.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, we are back with Butch Vig. So tell us about that, going into the studio, where you recorded it, what your approach was with the band after hearing the songs raw like that live.
Well, we recorded the album at Sound City, which is in the Valley in Los Angeles. It's a very famous studio. Tons and tons of huge records were done there. Tom Petty, the Jackson 5, Fleetwood Mac. And they had this vintage Neve console that was custom made. They just had this incredible sound. That's part of the sound of that record, as we recorded everything through the Neve. The other thing is the room was like a small gymnasium. Not very fancy looking, but it had a great live sound to the ambience. So it was kind of bulletproof in a way. You could set the drums up and just put up a couple room mics and just had this great live sound. So, but it was really no frills. And another reason we chosen, the band wanted to go there, it was really cheap. I mean, I think it was $600 or $700 a day, which is cheap, you know, because a lot of the studios in the big tracking rooms were $1,500 or $2,000 a day to get into a Class A tracking room. But Sound City was perfect. I think the no frills was good because The production is really simple on the record. There's not a lot of trickery going on. It's basically recording a band live in a room. I mean, that was my focus. I wanted to capture them live and then made sure I had a great performance. Then we went back and overdubbed some extra guitars and some vocals and backing vocals and occasionally a few other things, percussion and things like that. But it's a really, really simple sounding record.
So how did Kurt feel about overdubbing the vocals and the guitars?
Well, he didn't really like it when I had him do it for the Smart Sessions, you know, for those early Sub Pop recordings. But the first day we sat down, I said, I really want to capture the energy of you guys, but it needs to sound widescreen. It needs to be bigger than life. And they're like, yeah, of course we want to do that. And Kurt kept saying, I want to sound heavier than Black Sabbath. He kept referencing that. I go, okay, we'll make it sound heavier than Black Sabbath. I can't remember what the first track we did. It might have been Drain You. I know the songs that I knew were key tracks. I always like to wait and record a few songs first so I know I've got things dialed in just sonically and just vibe-wise. So we didn't cut Teen Spirit right off the bat or In Bloom or Come As You Are or Lithium. I saved those for like three or four songs into the recording process. But I basically, you know, told them, you guys play like you have been playing every day in rehearsal. And I spent a lot of time getting the sound on the drums, getting the bass tweaked out. And then I had a couple different amps. Kurt had a Mesa Boogie amp, but I also brought in a Fender Bassman and a Vox AC30. And I think there's a small Marshall there. So we had some options for amplifiers. And depending on the song, I would, you know, change things up just sonically. But once I was set, they would go in and they usually got a song in like one or two or three takes, you know, four at tops. And as soon as it was done, I would have Kurt go back and double track his main rhythm. And then there for their clean parts, I would go, let's go overdub that with a separate sound. And so, and initially he was totally up for that. And then as soon as he started doing it, he would get a little, oh man, I don't want to do that again. You know, really impatient. But I kept saying, you know, we're trying to make this sound larger than life, man. Let's go for it. And then the first track we got to, when I wanted him to overdub extra vocals, he just said, I really don't feel like I should do that. It just feels fake. And I kept saying, the Beatles double tracked all their vocals. Listen to John Lennon. Listen to Paul McCartney. All the vocals are double tracked. And he sat there silent for about 5 seconds. And he went, okay. And then he went in and he double tracked his vocal. And pretty much every chorus on the album is double tracked, and some of the verses are double tracked. So Kurt understood that to produce a record and to make it sound larger than life, you have to use some of the tools available in the studio too, or some of the process of doing that. And some of that is double tracking, it's compression, EQ, effects, you know, echo or chorus or reverb, whatever you decide to use. But he was wary of that because I think he was, now that he had signed to Geffen, he wanted to retain his punk authenticity. I had to be careful of how I got him to do the double tracking and any extra overdubs and make him feel comfortable that he wasn't going into a zone where the record would sound overproduced or wouldn't sound true to who they were as a band. So as I said earlier, I mean, the recording is really simple. It's basically them playing the song with some overdubs and some harmonies and vocals. And I really concentrated more on the performance and the sound of everything being recorded. And that's really the sound of Nevermind.
Did he feel, and did the band feel, from your perspective, pressure when they were in the studio about wanting to be successful with this album, but at the same time retaining that kind of that underground authenticity?
I didn't feel any pressure at all. I mean, they were having the time of their life. I told the label, just kind of leave us alone, you know? So there weren't a lot of people coming into the studio. L7 came by the studio for a day and hung out, which is really fun. They had a crazy food fight in the lounge with this barbecue, which was a terrible, terrible mess. And I felt really bad for the assistant engineer who had to clean it up that day.
Yeah.
But it was funny.
I bet.
I think toward the end of the sessions, their management came by for half an hour and stopped in, and some of the people from Geffen popped in for a little bit, but basically they just left me alone. And so that was good. So it was basically myself and the band and the assistant engineer, and they're just recording.
So with Teen Spirit, do Do you recall any other specifics in terms of how you felt or guidance to Kurt as he sang the song or anything along those lines?
Well, I knew that Kurt would only do a lead vocal 3 or 4 times. So the first thing I would do is say, okay, I just want to get a vocal, a test, get your headphone check and get a mic test. Of course, I would record it. So he thought it was just a warm up. So that was like take one. And then maybe I'd maybe get 2 or 3 more takes out of him, and then he wouldn't sing anymore. Part of it's because he sang so hard, and his voice would get blown out after 3 or 4 takes. I kind of had a system down at that point for doing vocals, the type of compression I used, and EQ, and I used the microphone I used. So I knew once I got it set for him, anytime he wanted to sing, I was set. I didn't have to fiddle with it. I didn't want him to have to sit there and wait while I'm trying to get, oh, let's try this mic or let's try this compressor or whatever. It had to be bulletproof. So anytime he was ready to go, I was ready to record. We would finish the song. And then once I thought the rhythm track, the basic take was great, we would go back and just start doing some of the overdubs and build the song quickly. Usually we would finish almost everything on that song in a day. You know, they'd have a take done by the middle of the afternoon or late afternoon, and then I'd start doing the overdubs, and by the time they went home at 8 or 9 o'clock, the song was pretty much finished. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, we had a couple songs where we added extra harmonies and some extra overdubs, and I think we spent maybe 12 or 13 days in Studio A, which is the big room, and then we moved to the smaller room where we did most of Something in the Way, which has a much drier, tighter sound to it. And then we did Kurt added some extra vocals there. And I know Dave did a lot of his harmonies there. But basically, it was most of the album was recorded in Studio A.
Did Teen Spirit break out to you before it was released? Did you and the band, did you feel like that was something different? Or it was a great song, but so were all these other songs, which they are, but was there something particularly magical about that one?
Well, it was an anthem. The song is so powerful just from the start as it kicks in. The amazing drum groove that Dave plays with Kurt and Chris, the syncopation is just incredibly powerful. And Kurt's lyrics are so enigmatic. You don't know what he's saying, but you feel like he's singing about something that you can relate to. I mean, his lyrics are like that in a lot of the record. I think that's why Nevermind was so successful, because he couldn't articulate the frustration or rage he was feeling, but you could hear it in the songs. And I think that's one of the reasons it touched so many people of that generation. I knew Teen Spirit was going to be a single, and I also thought In Bloom and Lithium and Come As You Are, those were the 4 tracks that I thought I could all hear on rock radio or on college radio, as it was back in the day.
Right.
You know, but Teen Spirit was the one that jumped out. As happenstance or chance, there's a band called the Sidewinders in studio. When we moved to Studio B, they took over Studio A, and they were working with Neil Young's producer, David Briggs, who Nirvana had met with and passed on. They didn't like him. They said he's kind of a burnt out old hippie. Now, I met David Briggs. I thought he was awesome. He played me some live Neil Young stuff in the studio that just blew my mind.
Yeah.
When Nirvana left and then David Briggs left, the Sidewinders were still hanging out in Studio A. And I said, you guys want to hear some of their Nirvana stuff? And I played them some of the rough mixes. And it was the first time I saw anybody listen to Teen Spirit. And they were like, oh my God. They're looking at me going, oh my God, do you know what you've made? You know how crazy cool this is? And I was like, well, that's pretty good, right? And then I played it for the band's management, and they kind of tripped out, and I played it for your other friends. I had a cassette I was playing in the car. I like to listen to rough mixes in the car.
Yeah.
As I'm going to and from the studio, it's just a different perspective, and I can usually get good notes if I need to tweak something or the levels are wrong. So I was driving around LA with the windows down, cranking the rough mix of Teen Spirit, and people, you know, I'd be driving down the street and people would hear me roll by. It was kind of funny.
I bet.
So I knew there was something special about the song. And the funny thing is, when we finished, it got mixed and mastered. I went back to Smart in Madison, and I the Pumpkins came up. They were doing some B-sides that they were trying to finish up. And it was over 4th of July weekend. Duke from Garbage and I lived in this biplex or a two-story thing right on the lake in Lake Monona. So we had over about 30 musicians for a barbecue on the lake. Like Killdozer was there, and basically a bunch of Madison musicians along with the Pumpkins, and we're barbecuing in the backyard, and Billy said, put on the Nirvana sessions, the album. And so I put it on the boombox on the picnic table and hit play, and everybody stopped talking and crowded around picnic table, and no one said a word for like 45 minutes as the record played through. And it was done. Billy just looked at me and said, play it again. And so I said, okay. And I played it again. And then people were going, started talking while I was playing, but I could see everyone listening to it intently. Geffen must have just recently made some promo stuff, because the next day I went early into the studio, like at 10 a.m., started getting coffee going, and I checked the messages, and there were about 10 messages on my machine going, this is so-and-so from radio, and da-da, oh my God, I've heard Nevermind and Teen Spirit. It's like, it's unbelievable. And people I didn't know were saying, Butch, congratulations, this is going to blow the lid off of rock and roll, leaving these messages. And I was like, wow, okay, so I guess people are into it. Yeah. But again, you know, so I'm thinking, wow, maybe we'll get a lot of college radio play and we'll sell 500,000 copies. Maybe we'll be as big as the Pixies. That was sort of our goal, you know, with that record.
Kurt was very much influenced by the Pixies.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah, very interesting. Did they feel like they had caught lightning in a bottle, that it would become the... in this rock and roll anthem classic that I think last I saw, it's reached over 1 billion streams on Spotify alone.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
None of us had any idea. And really what happened was MTV started playing the Teen Spirit video like 30 times a week. It was on like just constantly, you know, yeah, every day, every other hour you could see it on MTV.
Yeah.
And when that happens, you very quickly hit critical mass, like, you know, millions and millions of people see it. And then that happened all over the world, not just in the United States. And it caught all of us by surprise, because then it happened so quickly. They went on this initial tour, were playing some clubs, and then all of a sudden they were moving into bigger theaters. By the end of the year, they were playing arenas, you know, yeah. So it just blew up. I went to see him play at the Metro in Chicago, and we pulled up to the Metro, and there was a line around the block all the way. There were like 2,000 people in line. The Metro only holds about 800 people or 1,000 people. The show was sold out. There are all these people trying to get in. That's a good sign, you know, when it's standing room only and there's another 2,000 people waiting outside. And I went backstage and hung out with the band. They're like, holy cow, can you guys believe this is happening? They're like, wow, it's crazy, man. And
they like it?
Well, at the time they were excited. Yeah, they this is very early on. This would have been in August when I saw him play, I think, at the Metro. They were just like, holy cow, this is crazy. And when they started playing the first song, it was like Beatlemania. People were screaming and crying in the crowd. I was standing back by the soundboard going, holy cow, I have never seen this reaction for a punk rock band, you know? And I think that's when I realized that this was going to really fundamentally change all of our lives.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing how that song that you produced really defined a generation and continues to be just one of those lasting songs. Obviously, I was one of those guys who immediately when I heard it the first time, it blew my mind, and then saw the video and it blew my mind again. But that did transform lives, not only for obviously for you and for the band, but for the audience and for music in general. We're going to take another quick break, and then I want to get into some of the things that you're working on and a lightning round of other
All right, cool. Let's do
okay?
it.
Okay, we'll be right back with Butch Vig. All right, we are back with Butch. So from a production standpoint, from being a producer, what projects do you have or are you planning to have in the, you know, going into 2023? Anything that you want to discuss that you're working on?
I've been busy this year. I finished the Silver Suns record earlier in May, and then I went on tour with Garbage. We played from May through August.
I saw you. I saw the show in San Diego. My family and I went out to see it, and what a great show. And Shirley was amazing. You know, she was incredible too. It just it completely captured everything about Garbage. That it was just great to see you guys back on stage again.
Yeah, I mean, we're having a lot of fun playing live. Shirley is fantastic. I mean, she's the MVP of the band. She's so good and constantly surprises us every night.
She's a classic.
Yeah. So we finished in August and we had a couple writing sessions here in LA. And we've got about 20-ish song jams that we're starting to sort of tinker with and see where they're going to go, if they're going to turn into a song or just fall by the wayside. But it's a couple that we're really excited about. With the Silver Suns, we did a Record Store Day single called David Lynch has a painting made of fly's eyes. It just came out this last Friday for a record store day. We pressed up a couple thousand copies of the 7-inch. And the band's called SSVU, Silver Sun Vigups.
Oh, that's
so
funny.
So it's me and the Silver Suns. And we recorded two songs, David Lynch and the B-side is Suzanne Ciani. And we consider ourselves an art rock band that comments on political and artistic culture, or pop culture. Pop culture, I think, is probably more apropos. But it was really fun. We recorded the songs really fast. One, you know, we did David Lynch in about 6 hours, and the next day we recorded Suzanne Ciani, and then we sent them off to get mastered, and they pressed it up, and it's out.
Was David Lynch actually on that song?
No, but we sent it to him. We have his blessing. Yeah, so SSVU just came out last week in vinyl only, but it will be going to digital formats, streaming formats, I think, in 2 weeks. So you'll be able to track it down and listen to it. But that was really fun. And we just shot a video. I'm redoing my kitchen upstairs that we were supposed to do before COVID and got postponed for 2 years. So it's all destroyed. And we shot a video for David Lynch Has a Painting Made of Fly's Eyes up there. And it was crazy because we filmed it backwards. So I had to play the song, flip the song over, and we had to learn the song backwards and sync it backwards. So it was kind of a bit of a mind melt.
I bet. That reminds me of the Scientist video from Coldplay, which was all backwards back then. And I can't even imagine playing backwards.
Oh, it's really weird. It was really fun. And it's going to be a trippy video. We're trying to give a lot of the video an homage as much as we can to David Lynch, some of his films like Mulholland Drive and Twin Peaks and stuff. So that's out. And I'm back in the studio with Garbage. I think it's February 1st. We hope to finish our new album by May.
Ah, great.
And then we're going back on tour, a possible couple different legs that we're doing through the summer into the fall. It's still sort of being worked out right now, but that's the plan so far for early 2023.
So you've done all these different things. Do you have like a bucket list item of something you have to do, that a goal of yours that you haven't done yet?
Not really. People always ask me, who would you like to work with? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't really think in those terms. There's a session that never happened that I was really bummed about. When we were doing Sound City, when Dave Grohl and I were bringing in different artists to collaborate for that documentary, we had a session booked with Neil Young, and he was supposed to come in to the studio and jam with Chris on bass and Dave Grohl. And I knew that if Neil played with them, he'd say, this is pretty cool. Let's book some gigs. You know, it'd be like Crazy Horse on steroids. And then Neil had a book out at the time. Something happened in his schedule, and he couldn't fly in to do the session. So we were all bummed. The engineer and I, we had everything set up, the amps, and Dave and Chris are ready to jam with Neil Young. It would have been incredible. But
it would have been epic.
But it never happened. Maybe still someday. We'll see.
So what are you most proud of everything in your career?
There's a couple that stick out. Obviously, Nevermind is, it changed my life profoundly, and everyone closely associated with it, it changed their life. Siamese Dream, I worked on incredibly hard because Billy and I pushed each other to sort of raise the sonic bar and what we wanted to make that record sound like. And it was very challenging, but I think it still sounds really good. The first Garbage record was quite crazy because at that point, I'd sort of grown tired of recording drums, bass, and guitars, and I got enamored with working with samplers. And a lot of that first Garbage record is the music is everything's going through samplers, and we're processing it and making loops and whatever. And so when that first record came out, it took a lot of people by surprise. And I think it was risky for me to make that record. Everybody kept saying, why are you going back and starting a band? You're a successful producer. And if Garbage flops, that's going to look bad on you, you know. But I just had faith in the songs and faith in the band and faith in Shirley. After we met her, I just felt there was something special about it. So cut to 25 years later, we're making album number 8.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. So I got to ask you about meeting Shirley, because of course, rock and roll lore has it that her initial audition with you all was, she was talking about that a little bit, that she didn't feel like, well, you know, that wasn't great.
Well, it's true. She came to Madison after Steve saw her band Angelfish. They played her video once on 120 minutes on Sunday night, and Steve taped it and brought it to VHS in the studio. He goes, I think she's great. And we looked at it, go, wow, we really liked her singing, and she looked cool. So we flew to London and met her and really liked her a lot and said, so you should come to Madison and we'll work on some songs. Now, what we should have done then, in hindsight, is sent her a cassette with three or four of the music things that we'd worked on, but we didn't. So when she flew to Madison,
yeah,
she came into the studio. It wasn't even a studio. We had set up a temporary recording space in Steve's basement in Madison. And we had the core of some songs, like we had Vow and Stupid Girl and Queer and maybe a couple other ones. But we'd call up a song and go, okay, sing something, you know, go for it and just roll it. And, you know, so it's really hard to do if someone plays a song for you and they don't, you know, you can start ad-libbing and making stuff up, but you can get really self-conscious really quick too. Like, yeah, this is really bad. Yeah. And usually, at least for me, it's nice to live with something and then you can start to get your head into what the track sounds like. And then you can maybe start forming some lyrics or some melodies or come up with some ideas. So we, you know, sort of inadvertently put way too much pressure, and she tried some things, but we could tell that she felt kind of tentative. And I think that she didn't feel that comfortable in what she was doing, but we got along. Okay. And we said, well, this is cool. I think she was there for 2 or 3 days and she flew back to Scotland. We listened to some of the stuff and there were a few little bits and pieces, you know, Duke and Steve, like, well, this part's kind of cool. Her voice sounds cool here. And then she called us about a week later and said, I think I know what to do in these songs. And so we flew her back and then she sang Queer. And in the meantime, I had sang sort of a rough vocal of Queer.
Yeah.
And I'd written some more lyrics to it and I sang it like really distorted aggro. It sounded like Trent Reznor in early Nine Inch Nails. And Shirley heard it and sang it the exact opposite, like really mellow. Hey, boy, take a look at me. Yeah. And we're all like, whoa, it was way more intense that way. And so she got it. She kind of knew, I think she figured out right away how to fit in to the sound of Garbage. And through the whole course of that first record, she really kind of came on as a songwriter too. Yeah. And by the time we did version 2.0, she took ownership of, she realized I'm the lead singer in this band and I need to step up in terms of what I do on stage, in terms of what I'm contributing, writing lyrics and, you know, vision for the band. So as I said earlier, Shirley's the MVP.
I can imagine for anybody coming into that studio, let's face it, you were coming off this massive success and you were a well-known producer. That's pretty intimidating in and of itself.
To be honest, we were unsure how good the music was we were playing her too. So we were sort of, you know, we have these songs that they might suck. We're playing them for Shirley and she's listening, yeah, to him, trying to figure out what to do. It was terribly awkward. Like I, as a producer, I hate it when I get invited to some office, a publisher or producer or a label or a band, and they go, hey, we want you to listen to this song. You know, are you interested in working with this band or what do you think of the single or whatever? And then, so I sit there and listen and everybody sits in the room and looks at you listening to it. It's just incredibly awkward.
Yes, it is.
I would rather, if they want me to listen to something, send it to me and I will listen to it on my own time by myself and get my head into it. And then I will call you back and we'll talk
without through. Eyeballing each other at the table.
Yeah, it's just incredibly awkward, you know. Yeah, I've done it many times. So usually what happens is if we're bringing the label in or bringing people in, I put the playback up on the giant speakers and just crank it to stun volume. And then I leave the room.
Right.
You know?
So what's your favorite Garbage song?
I sort of think of it in terms of playing live, you know, what resonates with me. I still love some of the quieter songs, like The Trick Is to Keep Breathing. And I love playing Queer.
That's
Push
It song.
Is really fun to play live. The band never gets sick of playing that. I really like playing the song, Even Though Our Love Is Doomed, but there's too many. We have too many children now. It's hard to pick a favorite.
Your last album from, I guess it was 2021, it's like vintage Garbage. There's one song, I forget the name of it, but it sounds almost Depeche Mode-like. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
Oh, there's it might be, I think it's probably Wicked Ways, which has like a shuffle groove. And actually, we segue into a bit of Personal Jesus in the Middle. Is that the one you're talking about? Did we do that at San Diego?
You did that in San Diego.
Yeah, it's the same sort of rhythmic groove. And so we, during rehearsals, we decided, well, this would be cool. Andy Fletcher died from Depeche Mode last year. And I'm a huge Depeche Mode fan. Violator's in like my top 20 albums of all time. I love it so much.
Completely.
So it was fun to do that because it worked. You know, it was the same key and the same tempo. So we just drop it in. It's like the bridge of the song. We switch into Personal Jesus.
So which song of any song out there, do you wish you would have produced?
Well, man, there's thousands of genius songs and where the production is incredible. Off the top of my head, I would have to say the Verve's Bittersweet Symphony.
Yeah.
I walked down the aisle at my wedding to my wife to that song.
Ah.
I love the song sonically, the way the strings sweep and Richard Ashcroft singing and his lyrics. It just, to me, it's epic. It's very poignant and powerful. And if I had produced it, I would have gotten clearance on the publishing on the string sample because, yes, as anybody knows, they had to give the rights up to that and lost all 100% of the publishing on it, which is a bummer. However,
yes,
a couple years ago, Mick Jagger did the right thing and gave the publishing back to the band. So they finally own the publishing on it again. But it's an incredible song. And it just, whoever thought to put that, to blend that song together with those sweeping strings was genius.
Mick, it was the right thing to do. You've done okay. You've done okay.
Yeah, man. Mick, you have done okay.
Yeah, he's done okay. Okay, so Butch, if you didn't become who you are, sitting in your studio in Silver Lake and being a musician, producer, all of that, what do you think this young man from Madison, Wisconsin, where would you have gone in your life, do you think?
Well, I've always been a musician and loved sound and audio and recording, but I went to film school at UW-Madison, and I'm really into visuals and art in general. And I think if I hadn't made it in music, I probably would have ended up in audiovisual doing something, you know, making videos or films or working for a TV station. Hard to know exactly, but I do a lot of little video editing and stuff here.
Yeah.
And I like that process. And I have, if you look in my studio out there, there's all sorts of photography and stuff that I've taken over the years that I have off. And it's just really for my own personal use. But yeah, I like that process. I got very involved with the SSVU video. David Lynch Has a Painting Made of Fly's Eyes. As I said, we shot it up in my bombed out kitchen a couple nights ago. But I drew out a whole storyboard and I did a little test video where I performed backwards with a fisheye lens and to send it to the band to get an idea. And I worked with the director and came, like I said, I came up with a whole storyboard and all the shots and everything. And it was fun. I'm not going to edit it though. I decided if I did, I would go crazy because it's really tricky trying to edit reverse footage because it's never perfectly in sync. So you have to slide like sometimes frame by frame around to get it so it looks like it's actually playing back in real time, but it's backwards. And so we there's an editor we're working with in the UK who's going to edit it for us.
Can't wait to see that. That'll be very, very cool.
Yeah, hopefully it'll be out in 2 or 3 weeks.
Listen, Butch, it's been great to have you. Thank you very much for joining. Love all the things you've been doing with Garbage. Can't wait to hear the new stuff that's coming out in 2023 too. So
cool,
thanks,
man.
Butch.
Thanks, Peter. Bye-bye.
That was Butch Vig, legendary producer and founder of the great band Garbage, sharing his story behind Nirvana's track, Smells Like Teen Spirit. I'm your host, Peter Chatti. Tune in next week for my fresh interview with Kate Pearson of the B-52s, telling the story behind the band's most iconic song, Love Shack. And reach out to me at peter@deepcutsmedia.com with your feedback and ideas of which artists you would like me to interview next. For more of the story behind the song, make sure you like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and tune in each week for new episodes. And make sure you're following the Consequence Podcast Network to keep up to date with all our series at consequence.net/consequence-podcast-network. And as always, thanks for listening to The Story Behind the Song.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.